The Sports Interview with Anne Liguori podcast is brought to you by iBeCool Luxury Athleisure Wear for Men and Women, featuring the exclusive ice-fill cooling technology, along with SPF 50 plus sun protection. Look your best. Protect your skin. Visit ibkul.com to learn more. Welcome back to Sports Interview with Anne Liguori, and it is my pleasure to say hello to my brother, Steve Azar, songwriter, singer, guitarist, philanthropist, really a renaissance man. We had the pleasure of playing a practice round together at a golf event, the Robert Gomez and Denise Gomez tournament down and charity event down in Orlando. Steve, you are so much fun. It's not the first time we played golf together, but just to watch you multitask and do a million things and still hit great golf shots, it's really fascinating to hang with you, my friend. Thanks for being on Sports Interview.
And you're the best. First of all, I've not played good with you yet, the two times we played, but I did play really well at your event. I remember playing about as good as I possibly could play. I don't think I hit a bad shot at your event when we were there, which is unusual these days, I can tell you.
Well, we did honor Steve Azar at the Anne Liguori Foundation Charity Golf Classic, benefiting cancer research a number of years ago at the West Hampton Country Club. Yeah. And I was so honored that you and Gwen came in and tasted a little bit about the, you know, what the Hamptons were all about. I mean, I really want you to come back and play a little more golf at different courses and enjoy the experience even more. But your schedule to get you even to do this interview is hard. You are so busy. Tell us, what were you doing lately? Because you're doing a million different things and it's all good.
Washing my wife's car recently.
Yes, you did.
You know, that's why I was late for your interview for me and mine for you. No, we've been busy. I mean, I've been working with a new act, producing his record, his first songs. So that's always time consuming because it needs to be. If it's not, then I'm not doing my job. But also still writing, and I've got the new state song in Mississippi. So we got a children's book coming out with an incredible illustrator, Sarah Frances Hardy, which is going to take you a walk through Mississippi history, through the lyric of my song. Very, very grateful and honored to have it after 60 years, the state song. I mean, I originally wrote it for the bicentennial. It's as long as Freebird or American Pie because it needed to be, but it's extensive Mississippi history and it wrote itself. And, growing up here and leaving for 20 years and being in Music City and then coming back home, Mississippi looked, I was able to really sort of depict all the emotions and feelings I had growing up and turn them into songs. So I've written a lot of songs about home since I've been back, which are a whole lot more honest than I was able to do when I was in Music City, trying to juggle having hits and write about home. I grew up a big fan of Bruce Springsteen and Bob Seger and Mellencamp, John Denver, all these people that let you in on their world and where they were from, but they were musically tapping into the world because the subject that they were talking about, even though at home, that it was so vast, and I always wanted to be that for Mississippi and let people know that if it wasn't for this place that I love so much and grew up, I would never have written my first song, and I fell in love with it, and I was a victim in a good way of circumstance of being here and being raised here, and that's when it hit me. There's not a genetic bone, that a DNA in our family's history that somebody came out as a singer-songwriter. So it's from me being around it, and that's what happens down here. So been a blessing, and I love this place.
So can we hear the state song now anywhere?
Yeah, you kidding? Heck yeah. It's been out for a number of years because it was the bicentennial song. That's, like I said, that's why I wrote it. And I was commissioned to write that for that. But as the years went on, people kept going, that needs to be our state song, when I'd play it at different events. And then Speaker of the House, Philip Gunn, and Congresswoman Becky Curry wrote the bill. He also wrote the bill for the new state flag of Mississippi, was one of the authors of that. So he doesn't write a lot of bills. He came to my house and said, this song needs to be our state song. You've done it. And it was wild watching it go through the process. And Lieutenant Governor Delbert Hoseman and Senator Derek Simmons, who's on the Democratic side. It was wonderful to see both sides say yes There's always a few, and the media was attacking. The media was all over the world about this. So they were attacking using the three guys, two or three people that, you know, there was 100, you know, there was 90-something percentile, yes, in the House and Senate, but they just got a little difficult, and press would want to interview the two, three, or three people that really weren't looking at all the other side. You know, both sides were on my side. So it was a little bit of a trip watching that go down, and, you know, and it's stressful because it mattered to me. And I felt like as a songwriter, I felt like I got it right for us all. And I also feel like that pen was not in my hand, that it wrote itself.
I said one Mississippi, there's a magnolia tree. Two Mississippi, where a mockingbird sings out on his limb. Whistling that sweet soul for him. I said three Mississippi to this land called home. I breathe Mississippi till I'm dead and gone. Just carry on, oh, carry on, Mississippi.
The support that I've had. Now we got a video coming out with Morgan Freeman saying, you know, I don't want to give it away, but Morgan, Chapel Hart, who recently tore up TV on America's Got Talent, Marty Stewart, Jerry Lee Lewis, Bobby Rush and Cedric Burnside all just won all the Grammys for the blues. Dorothy Moore, so many incredible artists, Hardy, that have jumped in and in this sort of We Are the World version of We Are One Mississippi. So the video is going to come out on the birthday of Mississippi, which is December 10th. And it's just great to have the support of the music community and arts community that get it as well. So look, I moved my family back from Nashville. The kids were born and raised there until they were 10, 13, and 15, and moved them to Greenville, where I grew up. And it impacted their life so incredibly well. And this was something that means so much to me because it's not something I came home to do. It's something I was blessed at receiving during the process of this move, which to me verified a lot about my state and our love for each other. So blessed for sure and grateful.
Wow. I was going to ask you, I know your father, when you're 15 years old, took you to Nashville.
Yeah, he did.
And what went into your decision? First of all, tell me what your years were like in Nashville, and then what led to your decision to move back to your home state?
Golf made it happen for me, first of all. I can tell you the sport of golf, if it's not for that, not for getting to play free at Delta State and show your student ID, not for having one of my roommates be a great player at Delta State, he's from Chicago, Illinois, from Crystal Lake. If it's not for that game, there's no way I have a career. So my career was wacky. I was doing this. I represented the World's Fair when I was growing up, sort of the future of music for Mississippi. And there was all of these things going on. And I was playing, sneaking in blues bars and playing Eugene Powell. I was influenced by him. He was making blues records in the 30s, hanging out behind my dad's liquor store. Just so much incredible history. Dad, first legal liquor store in Mississippi, was a Notre Dame grad, and his roommate was Johnny Lattner, you know, from Ohio, the great Heisman Trophy winner. So all these incredible stories that led up to me coming along and hanging out back there and just falling in love at the age of 10. I was actually made music in Nashville, and then nothing really happened. You're a kid. I got to play one of those songs for Danny Thomas and the telethon for back in the St. Jude telethon days. They featured one of my songs that I wrote there.
Wow.
And then you're just sort of playing sports and you're playing music. So your friends that play music with you have nothing to do with your friends and your teammates for sports. So I was living a double life. But both would come to help my career as far as competitively and writing songs, understanding the mistakes and the losses, how to get over it, how to write about it, how to come from the depths of scraping the bottom, you know, and then being able to sort of put a pen to it and express those emotions and be vulnerable, which taught me what you have to be as a songwriter. But I was shopping in New York most of the time, and Ahmet Erdogan, who's the greatest record guy arguably ever, I was in his office once, and that's where I thought my destiny would be, with the rock side and the rock blues side. I was a little bit of mutt, and he played me the song "Walking in Memphis," which was a tape, you know, back in the day, but it was a work tape. I mean, it was not a record. And he says, "I'm signing you, or I'm signing him." And when Mark Cohen, when he played me that, I said, "I don't have that." You know, that was a wake up call at that point. And I think I was a late teenager. I don't get my years right anymore. It's been so long. But anyway, he says, "I don't know what you are, but you're going to be fine. But you could be country, or you're blues, or you're right. You've got to go find yourself." And so I basically had a lot of tragedy in my band. One bandmate went home and killed his girlfriend. One bandmate, they went to prison. One came home, killed himself. It was an awful experience. I blame myself, because we were really doing well and playing everywhere. And I think the more money they made, the more it affected them in a negative way. But I still was the band leader and leader of the band. And I didn't understand all that, but I went into a really bad funk. And then,
was this in Mississippi, Steve? When you were back in Mississippi?
Yeah, no, this is before I ever left.
Oh, okay.
I'm still just getting out
of
college.
You're young.
I'm getting out of college. And so our band was working 200 dates a year. We had two 28-foot trucks on the road. We drove a Bronco with the band and the road crew. And I was playing a lot of original music, but a lot of cover stuff, because it was four-hour gigs, you know, back then. And so we were doing a lot of frat houses. That's where I met Gwen at the University of Arkansas. She would come see me play with so many others there. And then I found her. I saw her one night on the shoulders of a Sigma Chi, and I said, "Uh-oh, that's, you get my future wife off of your shoulders," you know. And 33 years later, you know. But the bottom line is that I had not given up, but I had. And we were home, and because of all of that, and I was playing just solo stuff. Jim Gallagher Jr., I'd play for the country club dues. I'd play on Wednesdays at the country club that you've been to, at the pool, and all the kids would be splashing water on me. And Jim Gallagher Jr. was on fire back then. So anyway, he hears me singing, and then he sends me to Nashville, along with, I was in Sudden Death at a tournament in Lake Village, Arkansas. And the guy, before they beat us, said, "Steve, I've got some friends in Nashville." And then my banker buddy from Guaranty Bank, Mickey Naiman, who let me build a house because my income was strange back then, you know, and he let me build a house in Greenville. They all had connections at one time, all from the game of golf. And I ended up going to Nashville. And all of those people, whether they ended up being someone that mattered to me then or someone 10 years later, they all ended up making a big impact on my career. It's crazy. It'd be too long of a story to tell you, but ended up getting a publishing deal, getting another publishing deal, getting a growing and growing, making a bad first record on an independent label, and then writing the hits with "I Don't Have to Be Meat on Monday" and "Waiting on Joe" and "Sunshine." And so the thing started to happen. A lot of weird things, losing my voice, having vocal cord surgery in the middle of it all. Yeah, it's just crazy. But what a life, man. It's been cool.
So you're saying that the people you've met in the game of golf, from the country club in Mississippi when you were growing up and performing there, and just the people you've met in the golf industry in general, has really benefited your career?
There was a time when I was playing really well, and it helped to be playing well. So we probably, my buddy and I probably won, I'd say 40, 50 tournaments in Nashville.
And they golf were one tournaments.
Day, they were one day tournaments, but we were so good together. And we were going low. I mean, like, we were playing. And then I had a stretch of 7 hole-in-ones in a short period of time.
Really?
And all of that sort of, you know, and so I was really playing well.
So you played junior tournaments, Steve?
Never. And I did find myself in a final pairing of a group with guys that did play golf. But no, and I got to tell you something. Being in that situation when you're – and I was hitting balls every day. So I was working at it. And being in that situation – it wasn't comfortable for me, because it was a big difference of not doing that. And I was a team player, a doubles player, a basketball player with 5 guys on the court. When I played football, baseball as a catcher, I was always involved in team sports. And when you're alone out there, that was the toughest thing ever. And not growing up and competing in golf, it's hard to wrap your mind around being able to handle your emotions and the nerves. Now, sometimes it worked out really good, but when I got into serious stuff, and you're on TV and all these things later in life, and the BMW and the Bob Hope, you know, you're going like, get those cameras off of me. That's not comfortable for me. So my game would travel pretty good, but, you know, handicaps are what they are. You know, mine's, I don't even know what it is now. It's probably about a 5, but it's really probably an 8, you know, or 9. But there was a time when I could travel with like a 1 or 2. But now, no, not even close.
So tell me about your childhood. You were an all-around athlete. You said you played more tennis than golf?
Yeah, never really. Well, you know, when you grew up, you know, in the summers, you'd play a little golf because you'd go swimming, or you'd come from, you know, had a baseball game that afternoon. So you'd have something to do during the day if you weren't cutting grass or working, you know, as a little kid. So we'd play golf. So we had golf clubs in our hands at a young age, but it was only a summer thing. And it was once or twice a week. You know, had a baseball grip on it, you know, and nobody taught us. But baseball was ruling in the summers. You know, then you'd get ready for August, you had football practice. And I went through 10th grade to 10th grade. I quit, you know, football. I broke my foot, I think, and then just decided it got to be the wrong sport for me. Golf was that sport. But tennis took over for baseball at some point. You couldn't do both and compete. So tennis started to do us well, won a few state titles in high school, which is different from USTA. You and I both know that the competitiveness in USTA is just really difficult, but we had some really good players in our school league all the way to state that you'd run into at USTA events, that were good. My partner, Ken, was, better than I was as a singles player. Doubles wise, we held each other up pretty well, and we played together forever. So we knew each other's every move. So it was good, but when it came to USTA tennis, like you, you grew up really doing it, I'm sure, right? So you were better at that than I was, but I was ranked okay, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I grew up playing junior tennis, and I was an all around athlete as well, though. I earned 16 letters, varsity letters in high school. I mean, I was a big jockette, which was really instrumental in my being a sports broadcaster, because having that insight into being an athlete in a variety of sports was really important to me. But when did you decide that music would be your ultimate goal and profession?
And I think that you have to make your decision that there is no plan B. Okay. There can be no plan B. And people always go, oh, I'm going to give this 3 or 4 years. No, it may take long. I have my first hits at 37. So I'm proof that plan B, that I stuck to that. But along the way, I got to tell you, I didn't know where to turn. So there were plenty of times when it got tough, you know? So with that said, having support of Gwen and just going like, this is what you're born to do, knowing that, you know, that made it, you know, having the spouse that believed, that was huge. So, and I didn't sit down and sit still, but you still can't just make hits happen. So it just, you really, and I was a slow learner of getting to the national system and wanting Mississippi to be sort of the leaking throughout, you know, weaving it through it out and trying to figure out how am I going to make that happen. So it was a little difficult growing up my blues background and everything, but it eventually worked out and I found myself. But I don't know. I mean, it was just really difficult, just the whole process of surviving the business, but you really cannot have a second option. Even though I went through everything. So I think looking back, no matter what, if I'm answering your question, there's no choice but one choice. And then what was the question? Because
And how old were you when you actually moved to Nashville?
27 years old.
Wow. So you were already established as a musician for many years in Mississippi. And what made you move to Nashville then?
I get those days on the golf course, I got sent there. And then trust me, I sent my music, and I'll never forget it. I sent the latest stuff because you think the latest is your best, right? Well, this will tell you everything. How about it? I didn't have a clue. And I'd sent a picture with one of the hookups, the one from the sudden death tournament in Lake Village. And I get back then you get letters, right? You get a letter back. We looked at, listened to your material. We, you know, that we're going to pass. So with all these other things that were going on, and I had to go, I had meetings set up in Nashville through Jim Gallagher and through my other friends, and you know, my bank president buddy, Mickey. I decided I had a little time. I was going to knock on the door of this place that said no, you know? So I knocked on the door and they said yes. And they go, I said, I'm Steve Azar. I know I sent my music. I was hoping maybe I could meet you. And they go, we already said no. And then he looks at me and goes, well, you don't look like your picture. Maybe you don't sound like the music you sent. And I said, okay, I'll take it. I don't know what that means, but I'll take it. So I went in and I played the same songs and they said, no, we appreciate your time. And then he goes, hey, I stood up, I put my guitar in my case. I stood up just deflated. And he said, hey, Steve, can you play me some of the first songs you ever wrote? Is there a first song you ever wrote that you remember? And I said, yeah. Now, I hadn't played these songs since I wrote them, and I was, what, 11, 12, 13. So I think they were probably 13, 14-year-old songs. I played them. He goes, play me another. Play me another. And he goes, you're a songwriter. And I went, what? Are you kidding me? And he goes, we want to offer you a deal. And so I went to my next meeting, and it was John Prine's guy, Al Bonetta. Now I'm a big John Prine fan.
Sure.
And so I said, heck with it. I'll play the same songs, those same songs. I played them. He goes, you're a songwriter. And I said, what? So I'm like, I've written hundreds of songs. I'd been in Ahmed Erdogan's office playing him all this other stuff, you know? And isn't it funny, the first stuff, that it was so in this honest moment where I wasn't trying to figure anything out, that there's no way, you know? And so anyway, he said, I'm going on vacation. When I get back, I'm going to introduce you to John, and we're going to do a deal. And so we'll do a record deal and a publishing deal. And so I couldn't wait 2 weeks. I didn't wait 2 weeks. I decided that I was signing. I went back and signed because I'd waited. I was 27 years old. I'd been waiting for... truly, since I was 11, I really wanted it. I wanted it at 11. So it was 16 years later, there was no way I was going to wait. When he came back, he goes, you couldn't wait 2 weeks, you know? Incidentally, one of the guys that I was sent to see, that Jim sent me to see, was married to, R.C. Bannon was married to Louise Mandrell. R.C. and I met him in a, they turned me down. They said they were looking for a hat act. And I obviously didn't need, I have a lot of hair. I still have a lot of hair, and I wasn't going to put a hat on to cover it up. And so a baseball cap, yeah. But anyway, so they said no. And I saw RC 6 months later at a golf tournament that I think he had won a bunch of times, Music City Golf Tournament, at the Hermitage where they used to play the LPGA Sara Lee Classic. And so I went it, and we become friends, and we start playing golf. We played golf for 9 or 10 years. 9 years, we never wrote a song, and then we wrote I Don't Have to Be Me Until Monday together after playing all this golf together. So that was the 10-year later guy, and then we had a hit together, and we never.
I was going to ask you about that. So that was released, your hit single, I Don't Have to Be Me Till Monday. It was released in 2002. So tell me again, how did it come about?
We finally wrote a song.
It was you and who?
R.C. Bannon. We had just never... And then my buddy Jason, my sidekick, so the three of us. But with that said, RC and I had never sat down to write. We just played golf. And he was originally the first trip I took to Nashville after all those years at 27, said no to me. So we just became friends. And RC wrote a bunch of the songs for the Louise Mandrell, the Mandrell Sister Show.
Sure.
And he was trying at one point to get ready for the senior tour. He was a really good player, but just not good enough. And he realized that, you know. The senior tour where these guys were coming out of, you know, pros that were country club PGA guys that just didn't quite make it. You weren't, you know, the musician wasn't coming out of there, you know, and pulling it off. But he was good, really good player. And but it just shows you, you know, the plan that's ahead, that you just don't know the people you meet. I could have said the heck with you and not became his friend. And we became really good friends. And
where were you when you wrote this song, Steve? Were you in your... living room? Were you?
Well, we were in a writing room. We were at his house. You know, I got to tell you, the inspiration came from my roommate at Delta State who played golf. He had gone and developed a big company, an apparel company. He was making $1 zillion. And he came, his wife called and said, listen, he's not doing well physically. All he knew was work. And so she goes, you got to call him and tell him to come see you. Like I was going to be the fix. dear, dear friends. And so he was one of the best athletes I ever saw in my life. I coached him in intramural basketball once, and he scored 71 in a game. And we lost 73-72.
Get out of here.
Yeah, we did. 71 points in an intramural basketball game. It's impossible. So anyway, he was such a great athlete. And he came in, and I looked at him, and he was graying. And he was you got to realize he was 36. He looked twice my age. He was exhausted. He was out of shape. I had never seen him like this. And I thought he looked like he was about to have a breakdown. We came in. We a long weekend, and we played every sport under the sun. We made up sports like we used to, you know, but we played pool. We went bowling. We played golf. We played ping pong. We did everything. When he left on Monday, he said, "Man," I looked at him. I said, "You look good." He goes, "I got to tell you, it was good not to be myself." So I wrote a series of songs alone and with others that had to do with a long weekend, and that one stuck.
Got me a brand new car, waiting in the driveway, shining like a bright new star. I've been wishing on it every day to take me away from here. So I called in to where I work, told a little white lie. No, my back don't really hurt, but that's my alibi. My temporary ticket to anywhere but there. Call it an early weekend. Call it going off the deep end. Call it what you want. I made up my mind. I don't have to be me till Monday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. I ain't gonna face reality. 3 days without punching a time clock, 3 nights to go and nonstop, no work and I'll play. I don't have to be me till Monday.
How did your life change after that hit song?
Well, it was good and bad in ways, nothing ever really bad. But Morgan Freeman, that sat on record labels' desks for 2 years. Nobody, we made the record in a garage. Then I wrote Waiting on Joe. I love writing by myself, really. And when I wrote Waiting on Joe, that was a game changer. That was the one Morgan Freeman was featured. You know, we were up for Video of the Year, Best New Artist Video of the Year. And Morgan changed my life because that was my life story at that point in the song. And then the record label signed me and put Monday out. But it laid on those desks for 2 years. And then I had throat surgery. And then our label went up for sale. So by the time Bob Seger came calling, and I toured with him for almost like 8 or 9 months, and he hadn't been on the road in 10 years. By the time that came, I'd left and wanted to do my own thing with my own record label. So that was a battle getting out of a big label. Got out of there, and I've been making all my records on my own label ever since. It's been awesome. 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 Free. Freedom is a beautiful thing as an artist.
When you came back to Mississippi, how long were you in Nashville before you came back?
20 years.
What made you leave Nashville and come back home?
I have no idea. We were rolling. I had just come off my first top 20 record on with that called Sunshine, which you love. You've always loved Sunshine.
Baby, you're my sunshine, first light. Find your way to places that only know lies. Field tries, bruised skies, with hardly time to hold on. Be strong, I'm strong, cause like the dawn, you're pushing on the way. I tell you, you're my sunshine. Everybody needs a little sunshine. Your fingertips, a kiss to this time.
And I had written that on the first night of the Bob Seger tour at Soundcheck. And it was, Taylor Swift said it was her favorite song at the point at that time. And people, Reba had just recorded one of my songs, and we were touring together. And she was a guest VJ when the video went number one It's my own label. It's a top 20 record. And it was, everything was going great. Then I looked at Gwen one day and I said, what if we moved home? I have no idea why I said that. And first of all, we had a 7-checklist thing that had to happen. And the 3 kids all had to agree to go. And they're 10, 13, and 15. They all said yes. Everything sort of happened. And I swear within 3 months, my managers who managed Fleetwood Mac and ZZ Top, my agent at Keith Urban and everybody, they were dear friends of mine and my golf partners at the time. And we cooked together. We spent Thanksgiving together. When I went and sat down and told them I wanted to move home, they looked at me and said, are you crazy? And so we moved. I remember the move being very difficult, but this is when I knew that things were right. I was sitting in the studio here where I'm talking to you from. I'd set my studio up. You can't see all this stuff. And I sat there and I put my head in my hands in my head and I said, what did I just do? I just left everything. I left momentum again that was gone, and it's my own label. And things are going great. And then all of a sudden the phone rang right then, and it was Oprah's people. And they were saying that, hey, this song Sunshine, we were Cat Cora, Iron Chef turned us on to you. You're going to be featured in Oprah's Top Things to Buy at Christmas with this album Slide On Over Here of yours. And I just said, there you go. I have no control over this, that there's a higher plan. And that made me feel good about my move. And then lots going on. I've been the music and culture ambassador for the state for the last 5 or 6 years. The state song comes along now. And my radio show, In a Mississippi Minute, 5 years. I'm still playing 50 dates a year as an artist. So there's a lot going on. It's all been just glorious, glorious.
And you can make your own decisions, run your own show, and do it from the state you love the most.
I can wake up and move on my own clock. And you know, Anne, as an artist and somebody that does what you do, when you can control your day, you know, I'm a guy that goes, I love a blower. Like, I get out and blow leaves because you know what it does for me? It's instant gratification to watch something you're doing happen. And in our business, you sit and wait. You'd wait on this, wait on lunch for some, perhaps with somebody. I waited on lunch with one guy in the record business for 10 years, you know, and 10 years to have lunch with one guy. And I'm going like, forget that waiting. Now, I did need a major label to get things really kicked off. I did need that. So I believe in that. But I also believe at some point we did the right thing. And the freedom and then the songs that I've been writing and about home and everything have been really the greatest stuff that, and it's the most honest stuff that I've ever done. So to me, that makes it the best.
Who has inspired you the most in your musical career?
Eugene Powell, for sure. First time ever seeing it. When you walk in my house, the first thing you see is a painting of Eugene. Changed my life, changed the course of my life and the direction. There were so many mentors along the way. Mark Allen Springer wrote so many great songs, so many number one songs for the best artists. But we used to play basketball together. He was a college basketball player, and he welcomed me into his world and helped teach me to write better, you know, let me do my thing, but was there every once in a while to go, hey, wait, you need to think about this. And he was songwriter of the year at one point. Roger Murrah was songwriter of the decade. So that means they made more money. Mark made more money as a songwriter than anybody in the world that year. Roger made more than anybody in the decade. That means how many hits they had, right? So that's how you become songwriter of the year or the decade. And I wrote for a publishing company, co-publishing with them. They allowed me to be their partner. And then a guy named Rafe Van Hoy. We were making records in his basement. Rafe wrote the song What's Forever For when he was 17. And he had so many hits. And they just sort of, Rafe just said, Steve, will you just be you? And we'll take care of the rest. And along the journey, everybody was wanting me to be them and sort of turn into them because it was their success. And I couldn't do that. So Rafe was huge, pivotal. And just, you know, folks like you along the way that befriend me. You're constant inspiration to keep going and to do these things, just hearing kind words from you. I got to tell you, it means a lot.
Well, that's amazing that you mentioned me in that as far as inspiration goes. I find inspiration in you and other artists as well. I just saw Ed Sheeran last night at an Irish function in the city. And oh, my God, what a talented
I saw your post.
Songwriter,
and I said,
right?
Where are you? It looks like 7 people are in the room. I mean, people were in that room.
Oh, man. at least 800. But Ed Sheeran, what are your thoughts about that young man? Oh. He's very talented as a songwriter and singer.
Well, he's loosened up the game. So he goes out on stage by himself and he starts, right? Was he alone?
Yes.
Yeah, he's got his stuff. I've got one of those boxes.
He and a guitar, baby. That's it.
Yeah, yeah. And he's insane, right? And so he was another guy that came along like Willie. You think of Randy Travis when country, when certain things that happened. I don't know where you can think about when people sort of switch genres and listen to music, but Ed Sheeran is one of those guys that changed the way people make music. And he's phenomenal. He's phenomenal. So that's cool. I bet that was an incredible show.
I find inspiration from somebody like that. I wasn't as familiar with him. From Alex Lifeson, we talked about, the Hall of Fame guitarist for Rush. When I met him at Robbie Krieger's Celebrity Tournament a number of years ago, I really didn't know much about Rush. I didn't know much about Alex Lifeson. Before I had him on my radio show, because he's such a passionate golfer, I watched the documentaries about him. Three very humble, small-town Canadian guys. We got to know him. We honored Alex Lifeson at the Anne LaGore Foundation Charity Golf Classic at Maidstone this year. What are your thoughts of Alex Lifeson as a fellow guitarist, songwriter? I mean, how would you rank Alex in the world of music?
You think about number. I'm sitting here, I can think about Mississippi with Elvis and Jerry Lee Lewis and B.B. King and Jimmy Rogers and Charlie Pride and people that were groundbreaking, right? So we've been around it so much, it's just sort of normal to be here. But they got to be top 20. I mean, like, and I'm saying top 20 with Boston and Queen and Led Zeppelin. And I mean, the list can go on to the Beatles, because the Rolling Stones. And the reason I put them in there is because there was no one like them. There was nobody. And there was three of them on stage and they were making a lot of noise, you know, and that noise was prolific and beautiful. So amazing how they technologically felt. That, you know, Alex used to sit there with, you know, they can do a lot with three guys. So, yeah, I mean, they were game, and like Ed Sheeran comes along, they're game changers. You know, now they weren't the beginning of rock and roll. You know, you think of Chuck Berry as well, and all of these guys that came along that did, Elvis did things that nobody had ever done before. But Rush, in their own way, man, they did their own thing. And I don't think there's ever been another band like Rush, ever. They were just, you know, you could have people that came and tried to copy their thing, and a lot of record labels, I'm sure, signed a lot of bands that were just like Rush. Well, nobody's just like Rush. Signing a lot of people that were just like Garth Brooks. Well, there's nobody like Garth Brooks. But that's what record labels do. They see that fruit, low-hanging fruit, and go like, we got to capitalize on that real quick, you know? But Rush was one of those ones that a record label would have wanted to, they broke the mold, you know?
And there's nobody quite like Steve Azar. What is left for you to do in this illustrious career of yours, Steve Azar? You're always in motion, right? You're always thinking, your brain's always working. As I said, when we played golf, you were multitasking it. You were able to hit the ball. You're always thinking and moving. And what's next for you? You're not going to slow down. I don't think you'll ever slow down.
I know we love our kids watching what they're doing. You know, we were just at my son's first feature premiere as a writer director in LA. He made the movie down here right before COVID in that summer. And three of his stars, one's in Stranger Things now, one's in the new Nancy Drew series, and one's in Dahmer, the series.
I used to read Nancy Drew all the time when I was a little girl.
So these actors are really doing well. And my son was able to mix the talent from the Delta, and it was beautiful to see on a big screen in California, you know? So, and then our middle son's in med school, second year. Our daughter is the whole culinary thing. We are big into food and cooking. So we're living vicariously through her. So it's really focusing in on them and still getting to do my 45, 50, 60 shows a year, if good Lord allows me to. And continue to write. I'm about to put a series of songs out that are I want to put it in sort of an order. Last 20 years, songs I never put out, all the way to songs that are current now. Because my last couple records were with B.B. King's guys, Elvis's, Little Milton's. That was Steve Azar and the King's Men.
Sure.
Down at the
liquor store. I remember when you were doing that.
Yeah, and then I did my Mississippi reunion, and Cedric Burnside just won Best Blues Artist Grammy, his first Grammy. Been nominated for two others, and he was on this record. We did a song I wrote called Cold Water. So that's my Mississippi reunion, and that's the one with the state song on it as well. One Mississippi, where everybody can check it out on YouTube and all that. And then, so I wanna have a purpose behind the songs. Otherwise, I don't want to put them out. So now, and then I have a 20th anniversary song, a year, 20th anniversary year of I Don't Have to Be Me Till Monday version coming out now. So there's probably about 20 songs I'm about to put out over a period, but it's going to span 20 years. So I'm going to go retro, you know?
I love it.
So I'm excited about that.
Steve Azar, retro, yesterday, today, tomorrow, always the same lovable guy. My brother, Steve, thank you so much for joining me here on Sports Interview. Continued success, and can't wait to hit the links with you again.
Love you, sister. Thanks.
Thanks so much. The Sports Interview with Anne Liguori podcast was brought to you by Ivy Cole Luxury Athleisure Wear for Men and Women, featuring the exclusive Iceville cooling technology along with SPF 50 plus sun protection. Look your best. Protect your skin. Visit ibkol.com to learn more.